Cronus, and welcome to another episode of the Musicians Insider. And today we have Joe Iconis, who's on here, and I'd like to speak to him a little bit about his music career and what he's been doing, performing on things like Broadway and all over the place. So let's get a little bit of an introduction from you, Joe. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, so I am I'm a musical theater writer and performer predominantly. I've written a whole bunch of musicals, including this show Be More Chill that was on Broadway right before the pandemic. I've had songs on some TV shows. I also have a band called Joe Iconis and Family, and we perform all over the place doing my tunes. And my style is kind of like a cross between sort of classic musical theater and I'll say like indie rock. It's that kind of vibe. So in the world of theater, I'm sort of like a bit of like a downtown left of center kind of vibe.
So indie rock with Broadway. That's interesting. So you're getting that grunge vibe and that feel, but it's super professional and super prepared and you always know what you're doing.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It's like very well-planned chaos is usually what it is.
So yeah. I'm curious to know how you got into this, and maybe you could tell my audience a little bit about, you know, what kind of steps it took you to get to where you are, and just maybe any ideas or tips for my audience of what they should do if they're interested in doing the type of work you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I'm from Long Island, New York. I come from sort of like ultimate suburbia. No one in my family is in the arts or in entertainment in any way, shape, or form. But when I was a kid, when I was 6 years old, I saw the musical Little Shop of Horrors off Broadway. And I loved it. And I, you know, more than loving the show itself, which I did, I really fell in love with the medium of musical theater. Like, it was just this idea of like, oh, a story is being told and people are singing and we're all in this room together. And you know, I'm sure it helped that particular musical was about like a plant that ate people. You know, I feel like that really helped in capturing my young imagination and mind. And so I really fell in love with musicals. And so I became this kid that was like really obsessed with, you know, musical theater. And I would go to the library and I'd read all these books on famous musical theater writers. And I was, you know, in my town, I was always like the only person who ever took out any of the books about musical theater. Like, it would just be my name over and over again. And so around this time when I was like sort of developing this love of theater, my parents forced me to take piano lessons because we had a piano that was like, it was like a piece of furniture in my house, you know, like it was a piano that was passed down from my grandparents. And so I have a big Italian family, and for those who are listening who don't have big Italian families, my particular vibe was very much like a sort of, it was like a Goodfellas kind of thing, you know, like the moments in Goodfellas, like the wedding or like when they go to see his mom. It was like that kind of thing. And so, you know, we had this piano, and everyone was just like, oh, the boy should play piano. We got a piano, we should play it. And so I, you know, I took like piano lessons from a neighborhood piano teacher, and I started getting really good, and I started playing by ear. So I would like go to see a show, and then I would come home and I would pick out the tunes that I had heard on the piano. And so I became this like sort of little piano, I won't say prodigy, but I was like preternaturally gifted at playing piano.
And at that time, when you were taking piano lessons, were you asking the teachers to teach you those songs, or were they teaching you some sort of formal structured piano?
They were teaching me formal structured piano. But I mean, it, you know, my earliest teacher was this woman, Mrs. Jablonski, who was really great. She was a great piano teacher. But you know, she's teaching me like Hannon exercises, like very sort of standard, you know, classical music for children, which I was doing, but just had absolutely no interest in. And so I would, you know, I would like learn it. And then I would be, you know, as she was like teaching me something, I would be completely in my own world, like on the top half of the keyboard, just like completely playing these songs that I had heard by ear. And then eventually, you know, she called my mom and just said, listen, like, he's sort of exceeded my abilities. You know, you need to like do something with him. She was like, I don't know what you do with him, but he needs
something.
Something. He needs someone else. And so, you know, my mom and my grandpa, you know, they just had no clue, like, what the hell you do with a kid who is really great at, you know, at playing piano and making up his own songs and everything. And so I studied from like some classical teachers, like really good classical teachers on Long Island, but I didn't want to do that. I knew from the start I wanted to write musicals. And certainly at the time, you know, this was like not in mid 90s, late 90s. And so it was like pre-internet. There was just no resources, you know, to sort of connect me with a larger world of musical theater writers. And so I just kind of winged it. And then I ended up going to NYU for school for music composition. And that's where I started meeting other people like me. You know, that's where I was like, oh, I'm not the only person who actually wants to do this, who is alive. You know, there are other ones like me walking out there.
And that's when the light turns on. You're like, oh, this is a career now. You're like chasing it. And
yeah,
it turns that on. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Well, so I'm interested to hear what happened next.
Yeah. So, you know, I went to NYU and I studied with this private composition teacher. And at the time, I was really only writing music. And at the time, I was a very quiet boy. I was very sort of socially uncomfortable, let's say. And I was really inward, you know, I was like a really sort of inward kind of person.
Introvert.
And the introvert, yeah, they have a word for it. I forgot. And so my private composition teacher, he basically said, well, if you want to write musicals, you need to have some words. And so you have two choices. You can either write the words yourself, or you can go out into the greater world of NYU and New York City, and you can find someone who wants to write words. And you can collaborate with that person, and that can be your words person, and you'll be the music person. And at the time, you know, I was 18, and truly, I thought going out and finding someone sounds like I'm going to have to speak to other people. I'm going to have to be revealing of myself and vulnerable in some way, and also brave. That sounds like a terrible idea. I'm just going to write the words myself. And so that's how I started writing lyrics, you know, truly out of fear of having to deal with somebody else. And so then
that's great.
By the end of my time at NYU, by the end of my undergrad, I was writing lyrics, and the lyrics had become just as important as the music to me. You know, it was sort of it kind of went hand in hand. And then I went right on to grad school at NYU, and NYU has this really wild musical theater writing graduate program where a lot of like major, major, major musical theater writers are adjunct faculty. And so that was really where I kind of came into my own as a writer, and kind of as a man as well. Like, I had a big sort of change in my life and
a maturity moment.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. It was like late breaking puberty or something in every way. It was puberty of the soul. You know?
All of us people who used to be nerdy and doing things, like, I went to high school at 12. So late bloomer is what I go
yeah.
with.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The latest bloomer. Yeah.
That's awesome. When it happened,
I bloomed.
That's what has to happen, and it always eventually happens. So you kind of figure out what the heck, like, when you're growing up, everyone's always like, this kid, all this, and then suddenly you're in your 20s and 30s, and you have to sort of like make good on all the stuff you did as a prodigy.
yeah, really.
Oh, but that's great. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Is your main instrument piano, or do you play guitar? Do you sing? Like, I know that you were saying you're in, you know, creating music, right? And you must be now designing soundscapes. Like, what kind of what was your main instrument at this point, I guess? Is it still piano?
Yeah. So piano is my main instrument for sure. And I play I play, I played trombone in high school, and so I do. Trombone is an instrument that I can, if it's in front of me, I can play it, but I don't. It's not a big part of my life, you know.
Clarinet.
Oh yeah, nice.
For me, it was
That's good.
clarinet in high school. Yeah, haven't really
A
played it
great one.
since.
A great
But
one, yeah.
it teaches you to sight read and play in a band and look at a conductor. So there you
Oh
go.
yeah. Yeah, great lessons. Great lessons for sure. But no, but piano has always been my predominant instrument. I've tried to play guitar so many times in my life, and I'm just bad at it. There's something about it that does not compute for me. And so I'm just an awful, awful guitar player. I've taken lessons, I've really tried, and it's just a disaster.
To be a guitar player, you have to be like into Eddie Van Halen, into like Dimebag Darrell, into the guitar players that you grew up watching and you're trying to learn them. And I used to go to all Metallica shows and learn the songs before the tab books were ever correct.
Right.
But
Yeah.
now the kids have YouTube. It's so unfair.
I know there's just tutorials for everything now.
It's like, it's so saturated. It's almost like there are no more rock stars almost. It's so weird.
No, I know. It's very strange, all of it. Yeah,
Like
if
anyone
only.
new looks like a millennial, and you look at them like, oh, that's cute. They made a hit.
I know. No, it's the democratization of art and all of that.
So continue on if you want. I'm just going to say, I notice you have a lot of things that you've been working on. So I'd love to hear basically some of the bigger things that basically got your career rolling. Like what was your break, or what do you feel like is your, or are you still waiting for your break, or where are you at?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've, in the world of musical theater, I think I've done all right. It's I had sort of a I've had sort of a weird journey in terms of that. When I kind of started, I kind of came out, sort of into the musical theater scene post NYU graduation, like 2005, 2006, and I was really like known as the guy who wrote like these edgy rock musicals. And for me, I always felt like my stuff was really traditional, but the sound of it was really different than anything else going on in musical theater. And I think that is because when I sort of had this change, this maturity, right? I then all of a sudden was like, oh, I've been listening exclusively to cast albums of musicals for my whole life. I should perhaps just investigate other types of music that are in existence. And so then I feel like I sort of exclusively listened to anything that was not musical theater. And so that's when I sort of got into just regular people music, and because of that, my stuff, and this is still the case, the bones of it, the sort of structure of it is really kind of classic musical theater writing, where there's like really solid song structures. It's really character based. It's really like word based. But the sound of it is stuff that we don't normally associate with like show tunes, So it's like,
Indie
rock. I mean, that's kind of like the easy catch. That's what I mean. I feel like I say indie rock so much to people in musical theater because no one knows what the hell that means. And so it's like you say indie rock and they just hear like cool and kind of scary,
I would throw in the word punk once in a while, just to freak them out.
I say that I have a punk rock energy, and
See,
that
and
always is really
I can tell. I can tell that's where your vibe is. Almost like it feels like is it a CBGB's vibe too? Like from New York, you got that whole punk scene that's there, right? So you've got that
Oh yeah.
background in that. So
Yeah. But that's the like, but I mean, but the thing that kind of like sort of put me on the map was these live shows that I was doing. And my live shows were very much that, where it was like trying to take like a punky energy, right? Take a punky vibe and apply it to old time musical theater. It's like what happens if you have, Rodgers and Hammerstein or Stephen Sondheim, doing a show at CBGB's. And that was like kind of these gigs that I was doing.
So, like, more contemporary wise, American Idiot, Green Day, same idea, right? It's suddenly it's this punk rock band doing like Broadway. So, like, that to me kind of sort of is a good analogy to what you're talking about a little, right?
Yeah, for okay. sure. For sure. Yeah, definitely in that world. So I started doing these concerts around New York, and that kind of got me noticed. And then I kept having these musicals that I was writing that were premiering in New York, and they kept having a lot of buzz around them, and then not kind of breaking through in the way that people were expecting them to and wanting them to, for various reasons. And then I wrote this musical called Be More Chill, which was based on a YA novel by the late great Ned Vizzini. And it's like a sci-fi musical about this kid who's this really average, like, high school kid, and he finds out there's a thing called a squip, which is a supercomputer that lives inside of a pill. And he finds out that anyone who, like, has their shit together in high school ingests this pill, and the supercomputer implants in their brain, and then a voice just tells them how to behave. And so it's that's the show. And the score of the show, I was really inspired by, like, 1950s monster movie film scores and, like, 1980s, like, John Carpenter horror movie scores. And so that show opened in 2015 in this theater in New Jersey, and we made an album from it. And then, like, years later, the album exploded, kind of like out of the blue. And to use a gross word, went viral. And then because of that, and because of the, like, the sort of bizarre, rabid internet obsession with the show, we were able to do a run in New York and then eventually move to Broadway. And there's hopefully going to be a movie of it. And so it sort of turned into this big thing. And that was kind of like the way I broke through. But it was so, like, not the typical path of how you get your show to to New York, let alone Broadway.
So what I'm hearing here is that, and this is kind of the advice that I'm sort of hearing across the board, and I'm a musician too, and I'm having this issue, is that playing live was the thing that got you noticed in this story already. You said you put some concerts on around New York and people started to notice you. So it's like, basically, go out and play live, people. You need to do it. I'm guilty of not doing it enough. It's so hard to sometimes get it off the ground when there's so many reasons to, but I'm just taking away that seems to be one of the catalysts that still happens in the story.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah, for sure. Every positive thing that's happened in my life truly has been a almost direct result of me just, like, doing a gig that no one asked for, you know?
And that's
it's
such good advice. So just keep going. I'd love to hear more about how you got where you are. So this is a good story. So where are you at in your timeline now? So you've made it to the point where you've got past these shows, people are not taking you the way they want to take you, but there's something going on, it starts getting bigger, and then you get this viral kind of hit going on. So then what?
So I get the viral hit going on, get to Broadway, and it was, you know, it went well, it was good. Even with that, you know, I'm always sort of like, I'm always kind of like living on the fringes of whatever world I end up in. And so once we were on Broadway, then we became this, like, controversial show because people felt like it, because young people were really obsessed with it, and the sort of, like, theater, gatekeeper, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah. The theater crowd.
The theater crowd was, like, a little bit, like, noses up at the show. You know, they were a little like, what is this show that all these kids are coming to? And all these kids look so weird. I feel like we were, like, a little bit, you know, we were, like, a year or two too early, you know, as far as, like,
that's the best
to embrace.
Oh, you're breaking ground. You're the first, you're the pioneer in this area. I think that's wonderful. So you got ahead of the game there.
Got ahead of the game. Yeah. You know, but it's like, it's funny. I did, I did right before the pandemic, did this concert, in Lincoln Center. Right. And, it's this room called Jazz in Lincoln Center. It's this, like, just this gorgeous room that's overlooks Columbus Circle, and it's sort of this massive space and, like, the biggest concert, headlining concert I ever did. And so I was doing this show, and before, like, a couple days before going to see before doing the show, I was like, oh, I want to go see something in this room, this very intimidating room, so I can just be in that space and, you know, and feel it before I'm going to perform in it. And so I bought a ticket to see a show. And before the show, I'm like sitting there in the audience. And I was sitting behind these two people who were like the sort of typical, you know, like snooty theater people. Right. And so,
you could hear them talking about you.
And so it's like, they're looking through like the program.
Great.
And they turn to a picture of me, right? That, 'cause I'm going to be there. And it's a woman and a man. And the woman points at the man points at the picture and he says, oh, Joe Iconis is going to be here in a couple days. And the woman goes, ugh, like that. I was like, oh no, oh no, oh no. And he goes, he wrote Be More Chill, I think, right? And the woman goes, oh yeah, it's awful. And the guy goes, did you see it? And the woman goes, no. And like, that was like the ultimate, you know, like, oh, this is how a certain type of person thinks of me and my material. They're like, oh, it's like, ugh, not for me. Have you seen it? No, yeah. I've never seen it. I have no idea. I just know.
And that's such a good example of that. How do you break into that? Right. Like,
yeah.
I don't like you and I don't want to like you and I don't even know who you are, but I can tell by your picture that I won't like you.
Right. Yeah. Or just what I presume about you. Yeah.
You know what? That's not the kind of fan you want anyway.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, please. Absolutely not.
We buy our tickets each month from this certain group of people and we only go out with these aristocrats but you know.
I'm in a pretty good place, you know, like always trying to still get to the next level. But I have this new musical that I'm just about to head out of town to work on. It's this musical about Hunter S. Thompson.
I was going to ask you about that. I figured we'd get to it. I want to hear about this. So yeah, what's going on with that?
So this is a show that I had an idea to write so many years ago. I was commissioned by the theater that I'm actually going to do it at in 2007 to write this musical. And it is the story of Hunter S. Thompson, who, for those who don't know, was a famous and notorious writer who worked in the 60s and 70s and beyond. And he wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Hell's Angels, and is kind of this counterculture hero, famously played by Johnny Depp in the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and it sort of invented gonzo journalism, which is putting yourself inside of the story, which is basically how all of our news is handed to us today, that we don't even, you know, don't even think about consciously. But he sort of invented this way of writing, or at least popularized it. And it's a really batshit crazy bio musical about him. And we've been working on it for years, and we're gonna do this production of it at the La Jolla Playhouse. And it's directed by this dude, Chris Ashley, who directed the musical Come From Away and Memphis and many other things. He's like a big, huge Tony winning director. And I'm super excited about it.
And it's August 29th to August 1st?
August 29th to October 1st.
October 1st. Yeah. I can't read.
Yeah, no, it's all right. Reading's hard. So we're gonna be out there in La Jolla, and you know, the theater is beautiful, and it's where Come From Away started, it's where Jersey Boys started, it's where Tommy started, and so it's, you know, it's like as far as like regional theaters go, it's like sort of as fancy as you can get, you know.
Pretty iconic for Joe Iconis. And is that how you say your name, Iconis? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, good. I was born with it.
That's cool, man. I like it. So now you have a 44 track album. So let's hear about this. Tell me a little bit about how that happened. And that's a lot of songs. So
it's so many songs. Yeah. And my songs are long. So it's like, it's the only thing that bums me out about the album is that because my songs are so preposterously long, the if I wrote songs that were a normal length, there would be even more of them. It's like, you know, the runtime could probably include like 60 songs. But so the songs, the album came from these live shows that I do. So the live shows that I do are billed as Joe Iconis and Family. And the Family is this group of, singers, musicians, actors, performers, dancers, what have you. And we do these, you know, these sort of massive theater rock shows in New York City and all over the place. And so I've been doing these shows for years and years and years, and they have kind of their own cult following now. And there's so many songs that I do that only exist in these shows, you know? And so it's kind of like there's no other, you know, sort of comp in musical theater, but it's really just, it's just a band essentially. However, the songs that I'm writing for the band are theater songs.
And do you actually have like three other people you play with regularly, like your band, or how would that work?
Yeah, it's kind of like the closest comparison, I think, is like something like Arcade Fire, where it's like there's a core group, and then there's a million people who sort of like come and go depending on their availability, you know? So like,
that's awesome. It's fun.
And it feels like it's kind of its own thing, you know, like, but I just did a run of gigs a couple weeks ago here in the city, and you know, I performed with 20 other people. Like, it's like that kind of thing. So,
but you're going home after the show. You're not traveling on a tour bus. You're just doing them at home.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's the thing. Gotcha. Where it's like, because it's so big, it's so unruly, you know, it's kind of like impossible to tour. Although we're going to do an LA show in September, on September 25th, at the Bourbon Room. And it's, you know, that'll be a combination of like people who will fly out, people who are in town. And like, I've now been doing it for so long that I have like, you know, I have like satellite family members all over the place, you know, in every corner of the US. So
have you
go down and find some people?
I happen to be here. Have you done Canada?
No, I've never done Canada. I want to so badly though, but I have a great friend, Lorinda Lisitsa, who's actually in the Hunter S. Thompson musical and who plays with me all the time. And she's from Saskatoon. And so she always wants us to go and do a show there in her little town, Porcupine Plain.
Oh, that's cute. I'm in a small town north of Toronto. I lived in LA for 13 years. I came home when the pandemic hit. So I started the podcast as something to do.
Yeah.
Right, just something to do while trying to figure it out. Plus, I'm trying to figure out how to do music too. Like, I released two records, but then like with the pandemic hit, I had to stop everything, and I didn't release it till last November. And then it's like, we want new material for playlist posts now, and it's like, but this is still new.
I know. No, that's the most frustrating thing. The idea of like new. It's, you know, it's like it's new to everyone who hasn't heard it. You know?
I released two records. One is from 2005. And the other one's from 2020 at the same time in November at a double release. And I just said, just get the stuff out into the world. Yeah. I mean, but the key is, and I'm failing at it at the moment just because I have to book more, is just play live for people. Get out there and show them what you got and get your music in front of the right people. You never know who's going to be watching.
Yeah, you just got to. You just never know. And like, I mean, truly, this Hunter S. Thompson show, I was commissioned in 2007, and I haven't been like writing it since then. A lot has sort of happened, but I got the commission because I did a gig, and I invited the guy who's now directing it, Chris Ashley, to that gig. And at the time, he was just about to take over as the artistic director of the La Jolla Playhouse. I invited him because I had seen this production that he did of the Rocky Horror Show on Broadway that I just thought was like so badass and such like gorgeous rock and roll musical theater. And so I invited him, and he loved my gig, and he was like, oh, you know, I'm about to take over the La Jolla Playhouse. Is there any idea that you have for a musical that I could, if they want to commission you to write? And that's how this started. And it, you know, literally only started because I played a gig that no one asked for, and I invited this guy who came and dug it, you know. And I've always found that like, I'm good, you know, I'm good. I've gotten good you know, talking to people and sort of doing like the schmoozy thing. But I'm an okay schmoozer if I can be genuine, but I'm a really bad like bullshitter. And I think that so many people are really good at bullshitting and kissing ass in a way that I just can't do. And so a while ago, I realized, oh, I can't do that. But what I can do is just like put my stuff out there.
Let the music speak for itself.
Exactly. And it's like, I think it's good. You may think it's good. You may think it's terrible. But let me just put it out there. And if you respond to it, then we can have a conversation. That feels better to me than, you know, doing like fake complimenting at a cocktail party.
So you just concluded performing at 54 Below in New York City?
Yeah. Yeah.
Want to tell me a little bit about that, or is that still part of this?
It was, you know, that was, that was the run that I just did. And it was great. You know, it's sort of these summer gigs that we're doing are kind of, in celebration of this vinyl release of my 44 song album. So we put out this album called Album, last year, and it's, you know, sort of the culmination of so many years of Iconocent family shows and everyone on the album. You know, there's 70 artists across the 44 tracks. It was all recorded during the pandemic in studios live. And there's all of these, you know, folks who have played with me over the years, like Andrew Reynolds and Lin-Manuel Miranda and George Salazar and Cary Butler, like really dope theater artists. And we're doing this vinyl release of it. And the vinyl is coming out August 18th and it can be pre-ordered right now. And it's this massive box set. It's 5 LPs, 10 sides, 3.5 hours. And I'm really excited about it because I love how streaming makes music something that feels really attainable. I love how it just makes music something that can be in everyone's life in a really effortless, organic way. However, I'm super old school and I like music that you can hold, and I like music that you can like smell and, you know, and music that takes up space. And so it's like truly a thrill to be able to put out this box set that is just so impossibly large. That it feels like a daunting task to get through it all. And I love, you know, having to like go to a record player and change the record and do all that.
And it's something physical is going to sit in people's living room for years until they take it to a hawk shop.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I just love the idea. I love the idea of someone, you know, buying this box set and then it's sitting in a corner and then they move and it stays there. And then someone moves into that apartment and they're like, oh, what is this thing? And then they, you know, eat cheese off of it and then they throw it out. And then someone uses it to defend themselves against an attacker. It's just like so many uses of the music throughout the years.
And it's so much nicer than just having the phone with the Spotify, you know. It's like, yeah. Physical, tangible products are great.
Yeah. And, you know, I really like, I love the visual aspect of music, you know, and that was always growing up and listening to music and also, you know, being an adult and listening to music. Whenever I'm into an album, I obsess over the artwork that was associated with that album. And I want to see that's part of it. You know, when I think of songs that I love, I think of the album covers and I think of like the artwork and the publicity shots that were associated with that album cycle, and it's all part of the music, you know.
And when we were growing up, like we were smaller and the albums were so big to open. Mm-hmm. When you're a little kid, they're like this big and you're like, look, yeah, at all this, and the imagery just overwhelms you. Like I remember we had Saturday Night Fever and we also had Sesame Street Fever, you know, like, and that was, as a kid, that was amazing to have your own album for you to look at when your parents have the other ones, you know. So
yeah.
And now it's just like, I talk to like the younger generation that I like my relatives and nephews and things, and like sometimes it's like the magic, they don't even care about new music. It's so weird. And other kids do. You meet some kids who play music that do. So mm-hmm. It's like there's still, it's still there. The magic is still there. It's just, it's being passed down differently. And it's very interesting to watch people get inspired these days about music and what causes that. It's totally weird.
Yeah, but I do think that there's a strange kind of non-differentiation between the old and the new for, you know, for young people in a way that's like kind of scary, but also kind of great, where it's like, it just sort of feels like there's a sameness to everything. And, you know, I think that's just like, that's what the, you know, internet or social media or whatever does. It puts everything on the same, you know, plane. And that feels like, you know, frightening when it's like, oh, people react to, you know, murder in the same way that they react to like, oh, this celebrity, you know, sent a naughty text. It's like, it becomes the same thing, but, it's like
content.
It's just content. But then it's like the thing that allows, like, you know, running up that hill to like be a number one song, you know, like 40 years later. It's like, because the kids are just like receiving it all and then just responding to things in a really organic way.
Who can predict that Stevie Nicks' dreams makes a comeback because of a dude on a skateboard? Like,
hell, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Boom.
I know.
And everyone's like, oh, I love that song. And they're all like, that song, I'm such a Stevie Nicks. It's like, no, it's because of that video.
Yeah. It's like, where were you? Where have you been?
Do you skateboard? Oh. Are you a skateboarder? Have you ever been? No. Probably not, because you get hurt. I'm just thought I'd ask.
Oh, I'm not a skateboarder. I'm like a very unphysical
athletic.
Unathletic, yeah. Not an athlete.
What about hobbies? You got any hobbies that are not music related or anything? You're like, you do like anything that we would never guess?
No, man, I don't do anything but my work. Well, you know, it's really my hobbies and my, you know, my professional life and my life are very intertwined. The people that I make theater with and play music with are my best friends in the whole world. I, you know, my wife is an actor and writer, and I'm
with
me all the time. And like, it's, you know, it couldn't be more incestuous in a way that is problematic but also like really, really, really wonderful. But you know, I feel like everything that I like to do is in some way related to music or art, or, you know, I'm a big movie guy, and so I love film, but, you know, even that is like, I'm kind of in that world too. But you know, I like taking in art, and then I like having cocktails and eating food and talking about the art that I take in. That's basically my life. The only thing that I feel like love in my life that has nothing to do with art, is my cat, Diane Kitten. She's a big part of my life,
and she doesn't
care about art. She's 10 years old, and she's gonna take her first plane ride in a few days, and she's gonna come out to La Jolla Playhouse, and she's gonna be a California cat for 3 months with my wife and I. And so I'm trying not to freak out about it, because I also am like, I'm like a fairly in control guy, and I'm used to like high stress situations, and I'm always like managing a million people, and that's just, you know, like the way that I navigate through life, except for my cat Diane Kitten, who, if there is any situation where I feel like she is the slightest bit uncomfortable or confused or perturbed, I am like a fucking basket case dealing with her. And so I'm not looking forward to the thought of her flying on a plane, even though she won't care.
Do you have to buy her a seat?
No, you don't have to buy her a seat, but she has to have a carrier that can fit under the seat. Also, just to be totally, totally frank, this is how much I'm insane about my cat. I'm flying out to California on Sunday, and my wife is flying out on Monday, and she's taking the cat, because I was like, I just can't do it. I can't be on the same plane with her. I'm also like not a great flyer. And I was like, I just can't, I'm going to be like absolutely out of my mind thinking about Diane, wondering what's going on. And my wife was just like, please, the greatest gift you could ever give me is letting me fly separately from you with Diane.
And that shows you that she knows you so well. So that's great. You have a partner that's supportive like that.
Oh yeah. 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 No, she gets it. She gets it. We're good for each other. But we had to get some drugs for Diane yesterday that they gave us.
Sedation.
Yeah. So she'll just be high. She'll be high in a bag on a plane.
Wow. It sounds like a Radiohead lyric.
Yeah,
exactly. I just saw an amazing band called The Fretless, and they covered Airbag by Radiohead, which nobody knew but me in the room. And I was just like, and it was like a all string quartet at a thing that they did here that a friend of mine put on, and it was beautiful. Anyway,
yeah, I love that song.
So that's cool. Yeah, I play most instruments but violin, because that's the one my dad played.
Wait, so are you like, that's, it's not cool, or you're just like, I never
picked it up. I don't know. Yeah, weird. He was into that.
You have a musical family.
Well, yeah, my dad was a dentist. That's why when you talked about the musical, the first musical with Steve Martin. Yeah. Character, yeah, doing the sadistic dentist, I thought of my dad there for a second, because we used to laugh at that a lot, the Little Shop of Horrors. But yeah, I know he played violin. He used to run these old-time fiddle and step dance contests around here with the fiddlers, and like, he was mad that the judging was so corrupt, so we started running their own contests, and they would put the judges in the hockey dressing room so they couldn't see the contestants, because there was so much corruption and cheating going on. It was pretty funny. But he was also an orchestra violinist and had a chamber group and stuff. So that was really cool. I got him on one of my songs called Yours Forever, playing violin and viola. And that was recorded 2005. We lost him in 2008. So I still have him on tape, but I still get to play with him live. It's 2023. So we're good. But I mean, wow. And I got to see Dream Theater play last Wednesday. Oh my God. If you've ever seen those guys. And like, I just have to say, like, oh my God. Best instrument I've ever played.
Oh yeah. Look at that.
It's the John Petrucci signature guitar. It's just, I'm with Ernie Ball. I love what they make. God, now I can't blame the instrument, because I can do what I need to with these things. So it's pretty cool. I'm more of like alternative rock with EDM, and we run skateboard camp at Burning Man. So I'm into that kind of world a bit, a lot of EDM and a lot of metal. And
oh, word.
But the art at that place is incredible. But, and otherwise, I would say it was great speaking to you today, Joe. I really appreciate meeting you. I wish you much luck with your new Hunter S. Thompson musical. That looks like it's going to be amazing. What's the title of it?
It's called The Untitled, Unauthorized Hunter S. Thompson Musical.
Now I know why I didn't know ahead of time. Yeah. That's wonderful. So yeah, anything else you want to promote or tell me about that you got coming up?
You know, just be on the lookout for the Hunter show and the gig at the Bourbon Room in LA in September, and pre-ordering my album.
I think you're going to have a good time with the weather in Los Angeles for 3 months after the New York hustle and bustle. It's way more laid back out there, because I know, live there. So I'm saying, enjoy the vibe of LA while you can.
I'm gonna try to internalize that West Coast energy and the laid backness. It's not where my internal energy usually sits, but I'm gonna try to be.
Have a drink by the Lemmy statue in the rainbow. That's fun to do that.
Yeah, we'll do.
All right. Thank you so much for being on the Musicians Insider with me today, Joe Iconis. So we will be back next week with another guest. And thanks again for being on today. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.